pas latino. 001 matricule in danger. Mal on the way, the mal on the way, the mal on the way, the mal on the way, get 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 the mal on the way, 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 get 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 the mal on the way, on my double up, 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 on my double up.
From God's heaven, a star's light did fall. in the promise of the ages, it then did recall. Ooh.
Thank you. hold you, honey, I holler out loud. I'll never love another, even if I can. Oh, come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man. Oh, won't you let me, baby, just a kind of hang around. I'll always love you, honey, and I'll never let you down. I'll never love another, even if I can. Oh, come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man. I'd climb the highest mountain if it reached up to the sky. Jump off and fly. I'd even swim the ocean from shore to shore to prove that I love you just a little bit more. Oh, won't you let me, baby, just kind of hang around. I'll always love you, honey, and I'll never let you down. I'll never love another, even if I can. Oh, come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man. I'll holler out loud. I'll never love another, even if I can. Oh, come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man. Oh, won't you let me, baby, just a kind of hang around. I'll always love you, honey, and I'll never let you down. I'll never love another, even if I can. Oh, come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man. Come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man.
Gentlemen, the senator repeated, with no intention on your part or mine, you are participating in a small family scene, and I therefore have no choice but to provide you with an explanation, since I believe that only the captain, this mention led to mutual bows, is fully informed of the circumstances. Now I really have to pay attention to every word, Carl said to himself, and looking sideways, he was delighted to see that the stoker was livening up. Through all the long years of my American sojourn, to be sure the word sojourn does not fit in with the American citizen that I am with all my heart and soul, well, through all these long years I have been living completely cut off from my European relatives, for reasons that, first of all, are irrelevant here, and secondly, would be too upsetting for me to go into now. I actually dread the moment when I will have to explain them to my dear nephew, whereby frank words about his parents and their near and dear will, alas, be unavoidable. He is my uncle, no doubt about it, Carl told himself as he listened. He probably changed his name. My dear nephew has been, let us use the word that most aptly describes what happened, simply thrust aside by his parents, the way one tosses out a cat when it gets annoying. By no means do I wish to gloss over what my nephew has done to merit so severe a punishment, but his transgression was such that the mere mention of it is enough of an exculpation. I like that, thought Carl, but I don't want him to tell the story to everybody. Besides, he can't possibly know about it. Who could have told him? He was, you see, the uncle went on, supporting himself with brief bows on the bamboo cane propped up in front of him, whereby he actually succeeded in forestalling the unnecessary solemnity that his words were bound to assume. You see, he was seduced by a housemaid, Johanna Brummer, a woman of 35. I don't mean to offend my nephew by using the word seduce, but it is difficult to find another word that is equally befitting. At this point, Carl, who had moved fairly close to his uncle, turned around to read the faces of those present and see what impact the story had made. Nobody was laughing. Everybody was listening patiently and earnestly. After all, one doesn't laugh at a senator's nephew at the very first opportunity that presents itself. Rather, it could be said that the stoker was smiling at Carl, albeit quite faintly, which was, first of all, agreeable as a sign of reviving life, and, secondly, excusable, since Carl, in the stoker's cabin, had wanted to hush up his great secret, which was now being made public. "Well, that Brunner woman," the uncle went on, "had a baby by my nephew, a healthy boy who was christened Jacob, no doubt in honor of your humble servant, who, although no doubt mentioned only casually by my nephew, must have succeeded in making a profound impression on her. Fortunately, let me add, for the boy's parents, in order to avoid paying child support or enduring any other scandal involving them, I am not acquainted, I must emphasize, with either the laws over there or the situation of his parents, in order to avoid child support payments and scandal, they shipped off their son, my dear nephew, to America with irresponsibly inadequate baggage, as we can see. And he would be left entirely to his own devices but for the signs and wonders that are still just barely alive in America, if anywhere. And the boy would have gone to the dogs in some alley by the wharves of New York if that maid had not written me a letter, which, after many twists and turns, came into my possession the day before yesterday, providing me with the entire background of the matter, plus a personal description of my nephew, and, sensibly enough, the name of the ship. If my purpose were to entertain you, gentlemen, I could read you a few passages from this letter." He produced and flourished two gigantic, densely written pages from his pocket. "The letter would certainly have its effect, for it was written with a somewhat simple, albeit well-intentioned, cunning, and with a great deal of love for the father of the child. But I neither wish to entertain you any more than is necessary for your information, nor, in receiving my nephew, offend any feelings he may still nurture. Indeed, he can, if he likes, read the letter for his own instruction in the privacy of the room that is already awaiting him." But Carl had no feelings for that girl. In the thronging memories of a past that was waning further and further, she sat in her kitchen, at the kitchen cabinet, propping her elbows upon it. She would be looking at him when he occasionally came to get a glass of water for his father, or convey some instructions from his mother. Sometimes, sitting awkwardly at the side of the cabinet, the girl would be writing a letter, drawing her inspiration from Carl's face. Sometimes she would cover her eyes with her hand, then no words would get through to her. Sometimes she would kneel in her tiny room next to the kitchen, praying to a wooden cross. Carl, passing by, would observe her timidly through the crack of the slightly open door. Sometimes she would dash around the kitchen, and, cackling like a witch, recoil whenever Carl crossed her path. Sometimes, after Carl came in, she would shut the kitchen door, clutching its knob until he said he wanted to leave. Sometimes she would bring him things he didn't even want, and she would press them silently into his hands. But one day, she said, "Carl." And amid his astonishment at the unexpected familiarity, she led him into her tiny room, sighing and grimacing, and locked the door. She then almost choked him in her embrace, and even while telling him to undress her, she actually undressed him and put him in her bed as if wanting to let no one else have him from now on, and to caress him and take care of him until the end of the world. "Carl, oh, my Carl," she cried, as if clinching her possession of him by looking at him, while he saw nothing whatsoever and felt uncomfortable in the mass of warm bedclothes which she seemed to have piled up specifically for him. Then she lay down next to him and wanted to learn some secrets from him, but he couldn't tell her any. And she was annoyed, in jest or in earnest. She shook him, listened to his heart, offered her breast for him to listen in return, but couldn't get Carl to do so. She squeezed her naked belly against his body, groped about between his legs, and so repulsively that Carl shook his head and his neck out of the pillows. Then she thrust her belly against him several times. He felt as if she were a part of him, and perhaps that was the reason he was overwhelmed with a dreadful distress. Weeping, he at last got back to his own bed after she repeatedly begged him to see her again. That was all that had happened. And yet his uncle succeeded in making a mountain out of it. And apparently the cook had been thinking about Carl and had notified his uncle about his arrival. That was nice of her, and he would no doubt reward her eventually. "And now," exclaimed the senator, "I want you to tell me straight out whether or not I am your uncle." "You are my uncle," said Carl, kissing his hand and receiving a kiss on the forehead. "I am very glad that I have met you, but you are mistaken if you believe that my parents only speak ill of you. Aside from that, you have said a number of other things that are not so. That is, I don't think that it all really happened like that. You can't really judge things so accurately from here, and I also believe that it will do no harm if these gentlemen have been slightly misinformed in regard to details of a matter that they cannot really care so much about." "Well put," said the senator, leading Carl to the visibly sympathetic captain and asking, "Don't I have a splendid nephew?"
"I am delighted," said the captain, with a bow that only men with military training are capable of executing, "to have made your nephew's acquaintance, Senator. It is a special honor for my ship to have provided the setting for such a meeting. However, the crossing in steerage must have been very unpleasant. Why, who can say who else was there? Now we do everything possible to make the voyage as pleasant as possible for the people in steerage, far more, say, than the American lines do, but of course we still have not succeeded in making it a pleasure cruise."
"It did me no harm," said Carl.
"It did him no harm," the senator repeated, guffawing.
"Only I'm afraid I have lost my valise." And with that he remembered everything that had happened and everything that still had to be done. He looked around and saw all those present in the same places, gaping at him, mute with awe and amazement. Only the port officials, so far as their smug and severe faces permitted the slightest access, displayed regret at having come at such an inopportune moment, and the watch now lying in front of them was probably more important to them than anything that was happening or might still happen in the room. The first person to express his sympathy after the captain was, oddly enough, the stoker. "My heartiest congratulations," he said, shaking Carl's hand, whereby he partly wanted to express something like appreciation. When he then tried to turn to the senator with the same words, the senator drew back as if the stoker were overstepping his bounds, and the stoker instantly retreated. However, the others now saw what was to be done, and they promptly formed a chaotic throng around Carl and the senator. Indeed, Carl received congratulations even from Shoeball, accepting them and thanking him. The last to join them in the restored peace and quiet were the port officials, who uttered two English words which made a ludicrous impression. The senator was fully in the mood to completely relish the pleasure of reminding himself and the others of less significant details, which, of course, were not only tolerated by all of them, but welcomed with great interest. Thus he pointed out that he had taken Carl's most salient features, as listed in the cook's letter, and had recorded them in his notebook should unexpected use of them prove necessary. Now, during the stoker's unendurable prattling, the senator had pulled out the notebook for no other reason than to distract himself, and, purely for his own amusement, had compared the cook's observations with Carl's appearance, for they were correct, if not exactly up to a detective's standards. "And that's how one finds one's nephew," he concluded, sounding as if he wanted to be congratulated once again. "What's going to happen to the stoker now?" asked Carl, ignoring his uncle's latest story. He believed that in his new circumstances he could say whatever was on his mind.
"The stoker will get what he deserves," said the senator, "and what the captain considers appropriate. I believe we have had enough and more than enough of the stoker, and I am sure that each of the gentlemen present here will concur."
"But that is not the issue in a matter of justice," said Carl. He stood between his uncle and the captain, and, perhaps influenced by that position, he believed he could force a decision. And yet the stoker himself appeared to have given up all hope. His hands were half inside his trouser belt, which,
because of his agitated movements, had been exposed along with the strip of a checkered shirt. This didn't trouble him in the least. He had bewailed his entire woe. Now let them see the few rags he had on his body, and then they could carry him away. He figured that the attendant and Shubal, as the two lowest in rank here, should do him that final favor. Shubal would then have his peace and no longer be driven to distraction, as the purser had phrased it. The captain would be able to hire whole crowds of Romanians. Romanian would be spoken everywhere, and perhaps everything might then indeed run more smoothly. No stoker would prattle away in the cashier's office. They would have a rather fond memory of only his last prattling, which, as the senator had explicitly stated, had indirectly led to his recognizing his nephew. Incidentally, this nephew had tried to be of service to the stoker several times, and had long since repaid him more than amply for his help with the recognition. It didn't even cross the stoker's mind to ask anything of him now. Besides, while he might be the senator's nephew, Carl was a long way from being the captain. And after all, the unpleasant verdict would be issuing from the captain's lips. Consistent with these thoughts, the stoker tried not to look at Carl, but unfortunately, in this room full of enemies, there was no other place for his eyes to linger. "Do not misunderstand the situation," the senator told Carl. "This may be a matter of justice, but at the same time it is a matter of discipline. On shipboard, both, and especially the latter, are subject to the captain's decision."
"So they are," murmured the stoker. Anyone who heard him and caught his drift smiled queasily.
"Moreover, the captain's official duties undoubtedly accumulate to an unbelievable degree precisely during the arrival in New York, and we have already hindered him so greatly in performing them that it is high time we left the ship rather than make matters worse by permitting any utterly unwelcome interference to turn this petty bickering between two engine men into an incident. By the by, I perfectly understand what you're doing, my dear nephew, but that is precisely what gives me the right to lead you away from here as swiftly as possible." "I will have a rowboat lowered for you immediately," said the captain, who, to Carl's astonishment, didn't utter even the slightest protest against the senator's words, which, after all, could undoubtedly be viewed as self-abasement on his uncle's part. The purser scurried over to the desk and telephoned the captain's order to the boatswain.
"Time is running out," Carl said to himself, "but I can't do anything without offending everyone. I can't just desert my uncle now, right after he's found me again. The captain is certainly polite, but that's all. His politeness stops at discipline, and my uncle has probably expressed the captain's innermost thoughts. I don't want to talk to Shubal. I even regret shaking his hand. And the rest of the people here are worthless."
And thinking those thoughts, Carl slowly walked over to the stoker, pulled the man's right hand out of his belt, and held it playfully in his hand.
"Why don't you say something?" he asked. "Why do you put up with everything?"
The stoker merely knitted his brow as if searching for the right words for what he had to say. Meanwhile, he peered down at Carl's hand and his own.
"You have suffered an injustice like no one else on this ship. I know it for a fact."
And Carl drew his fingers to and fro between those of the stoker, who looked around with glistening eyes, as if experiencing a delight that no one ought to begrudge him.
"But you have to defend yourself. Reply yes or no, otherwise no one will have the least inkling of the truth. You must promise to do as I say, for I have every reason to fear that I will no longer be able to help you."
And now Carl wept as he kissed the stoker's hand, taking that chapped, almost lifeless hand and pressing it to his cheek like a treasure that must be given up. But his uncle, the senator, was already at his side, pulling him away, albeit with only the gentlest pressure.
"The stoker seems to have bewitched you," he said, and gazed knowingly over Carl's head at the captain. "You felt abandoned, then you found the stoker, and you are now grateful to him. That's quite praiseworthy. But don't, if only for my sake, go too far, and please try to understand your position."
Outside the door there were noises. Shouts were heard,
and it even sounded as if someone were being shoved brutally against the door. A sailor walked in, rather seedy-looking, and wearing a girl's apron.
"There's a crowd of people outside," he yelled, thrusting out his elbows as if he were still in the throng.
He finally pulled himself together and was about to salute the captain when he noticed his apron, yanked it off, threw it on the floor, and shouted,
"This is disgusting! They've tied a girl's apron on me!"
But then he clicked his heels and saluted. Someone was about to laugh, but the captain snapped,
"This is what I call a cheerful state of affairs. Just who is outside?"
"Those are my witnesses," said Schubert, stepping forward. "Please accept my humblest apologies for their unseemly behavior. When people have a voyage behind them, they sometimes go crazy."
"Call them in immediately," the captain ordered. And promptly turning to the senator, he said courteously but quickly, "Please be so kind, my dear senator, as to take your nephew and follow this sailor who will conduct you to the rowboat. I need hardly tell you, Senator, how pleased and honored I am to have made your personal acquaintance. I only hope that I will soon have the opportunity, Senator, to resume our interrupted conversation about American naval conditions, and that it will then perhaps again be interrupted in as agreeable a manner as today."
"At present, this one nephew is quite enough for me," said Carl's uncle, laughing. "And now please accept my sincerest gratitude for your kindness, and let me bid you farewell. Incidentally, it is by no means unlikely that we," and he hugged Carl ardently, "might be with you for a lengthy spell on our next voyage to Europe."
"The pleasure would be all mine," said the captain. The two gentlemen shook hands. Carl could only graze the captain's hand mutely and hurriedly, for the captain was already preoccupied with the perhaps 15 men who, with Schubert at their head, were entering the room, somewhat perplexed but very noisy. The sailor asked the senator if he himself could take the lead, and he then opened a path through the crowd for the senator and Carl, who easily made their way through the bowing people. It appeared as if these actually good-natured souls regarded Schubert's quarrel with the stoker as a joke, which not even the captain's presence could induce them to take seriously. Carl also noticed Lena, the kitchen maid, who, winking merrily at him, put on the apron that the man had thrown down, for it was hers. Still following the sailor, Carl and his uncle left the office and turned into a short corridor which, after a couple of steps, brought them to a small door, behind which a short staircase led down to the rowboat that had been rigged up for them. Their guide leaped straight into it at one swoop, while the sailors in the boat stood up and saluted. The senator was warning Carl to exert caution in climbing down, when Carl, still on the top step, burst into violent sobs. The senator put his right hand under Carl's chin, held him tight, and stroked him with his left hand. In this way, closely entwined, they climbed down gingerly, step by step, and trod into the boat, where the senator chose a comfortable seat for Carl right across from himself. At a signal from the senator, the sailors pushed off from the ship and were instantly rowing hard. No sooner had they moved a few yards than Carl unexpectedly discovered that they were on the same side of the ship as the windows of the office. All three windows were crowded with Schubert's witnesses, who greeted them with friendly waves. Carl's uncle waved back, and a sailor accomplished the feat of blowing them a kiss without so much as interrupting the even rhythm of the oars. It was truly as if the stoker no longer existed. Carl peered more sharply at his uncle, whose knees were almost touching his, and he wondered whether this man could ever...
Ondertussen staan we hier en is het ook erg warm en heel gezellig en heel leuke muziek.
Ramakeguri Narayani Namostute Srishti Shtiti.
Essentially new features which distinguish a free society as the definite negation of the established societies, and we must begin formulating these features, no matter how metaphysical, no matter how utopian, I even say no matter how ridiculous, we may appear to the normal people in all camps, on the right as well as on the left.
Over gecompliceerde vertakkingen en verwevendheid van zowel de politieke als de sociale apolitieke orde. Waarin het ik ophoudt te bestaan, diens plaats overgenomen door een zichzelf reddende en vervreemdende versie ervan. Het venster op de wereld verandert van inzicht in de omringdheid tot een transparant doorzicht zonder aanwijsbare duidbaarheid, verpakt in vlakken en stapelingen van dolende gezichten vol grimerende gelaatsuitdrukkingen, vertaald naar relationeel gedramatiseerde schaduwdansen. Vanaf de buitenkant verlichten schermutselingen tussen hulpeloosheid en aanvaarding die beurtelings winnen en verliezen. Een aaneenschakeling van pogingen, een sequentie van terloopse onafgemaaktheid, procesmatig voldongen feindelijkheden die zich moeizaam en niet passende jas laten verringen. De sociale ruis waarmee dit gepaard gaat, neemt een oordovend niveau aan. Stommen en mondboden dansen lachend op stelten rond. Een onafzichtelijk cacophonisch gehuil uitstoot wat door moet gaan voor politiek correct gedrag. Hoe het publieke circus zich ontwikkelt van puur huishoudelijk vermaak tot een intrigerende machine van nauwgezette, egotomaan omschreven patronen die voortdurend de hand aan zichzelf slaan, resulterend in de teloorgaan van gedachte en goed. Männer, der Erkenntnis reißt sich ein. Die Legion formiert, Befreiung marschiert. Befreiung marschiert. Der neue Mensch, tanzend, wir machen uns Gold. Der Blinde am Schein, der Freiheit. Kultur wird zur Dekadenz, Jugend verführt. Traditionen gebrochen, Staaten gesprengt, Völker verbrannt und freies Denken verboten. Die falschen Werte verbrennen unsere Zeichen, die uns verbinden. Sie verführen uns in eine kranke Gesellschaft, die der Mensch nicht fremd ist. Wir sind Verräter um unsere Existenz. Wir sind Verräter um unsere Existenz. Männer, der Erkenntnis reiht sich ein, die Legion formiert, Befreiung marschiert. Befreiung marschiert. Siegessicher glauben sie zu sein, wenn sie die Massen berauschen, wir sehen unsere.
ihnen ohne Wille und Kraft. Die Augen verbunden, die Ohren taub, das Herz entrissen, die Tat programmiert.
De onuitsprekelijke leegte die knaagt in een woestenij van dorheid en onafzichtelijke wijsheid. Die leegte, die onuitsprekelijke traagheid van bestaan, dat gevoel van onvervulde belofte neerdrukt, dat een leven vergooit in een uitgestrekte teloorgang, nochtans grijpend naar mogelijkheden, nochtans klaarwakker en met een wijdse blik het landschap aan te vallen, het landschap te vullen. Het landschap te ontdoen van zijn ondraaglijke leegheid. Een woestenij van ogenblikken die de luchten doorboren met een hartstochtelijkheid die verder gaat dan de waarneming. Een blik die duizelen doet wat verstoken achter de ramen verschijnt in een duistere, ondoordringbare laag van even zoveel sluieringen en omhulsels. Het trage ontwikkelen van de geest, de omtrekkende bewegingen van het samen zijn. Futiel als een halm tastend naar wortels. De wind die raast, de wind die huilt, de wind die knaagt aan de tanige wortels van ontheemdheid en die verlangt naar het vuur onder het dak achter het raam in de schemering van ons eindigend bestaan. Als verweest kind van het land, wegdolend en op zoek met een hartstocht welke de leegheid doorboort om te ontdekken, te vernietigen en te ontheemden. Uitgevlakt, omkaderd en ingetogen landschap. Landschap dat vlakt en plooit en in wiens plooien we onderdak zoeken. In de kieren van een gemeenschappelijk ik waarin ons bestaan ophoudt voor onszelf te zijn en uiteindelijk oplost in diezelfde leegheid waaruit wij kwamen. De reis terug, de herfst, de ongeboren kantelende hoekstenen die talmend om hun assen knarsen en onze gelaten besmeuren met een zwartheid en een duisternis die de ondoordringbaarheid van alle huidcellen en tere momenten overwoekeren met een godlasterende monotomie.
Vrije revolutie. Richtet zich op voor de mensen. Freie Revolution ist der Beginn gegen die moralische Auflösung. Legion formiert, Befreiung marschiert. Befreiung marschiert. Freie Revolution für ein freies Europa.
Melody.